and welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast in 2022. My name is Brooke Donnell and I'm the author of The Glass House, which won the 2021 Fogarty Literary Award and will be published by Fremantle Press in November this year. Today we're recording in Walyalup in Wadjuk Noongar Boodja. This is a place of Boola Bardup, many stories, and I'd like to acknowledge our first storytellers along with Noongar elders past, present and future. My guest today is the author of Locust Summer, David Allan Patali. David is a writer living between bush and sea north of Perth, Western Australia. He's worked for many years as a journalist in WA with the ABC and internationally with BBC World. Written over 5 years while travelling the globe, Locust Summer was shortlisted for the Australian Vogel Literary Award in 2017 and was developed through a fellowship at Varuna, the National Writers' House. Since publication mid last year, Locust Summer has been chosen as one of Gillian O'Shaughnessy's summer reads and named one of the books we loved in 2021 by Tony Jordan. David Allan Patali, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be with you, Brooke.
Describe for listeners what Locust Summer is about.
At first glance, I think Locust Summer is a homecoming story. It's about redemption, but there's a lot of twists and turns along the way. It's essentially the story of the final harvest of the Brockman family's property in the Midwest town of Septimus. The father is afflicted with dementia. The older brother, the natural heir to the property, I suppose, has died in a mining accident several years ago. And the youngest son, Rowan, our protagonist, gets called up one day by his mum. He's working as a journalist in the city. He wants nothing to do with the farm. He's essentially estranged himself from those relationships since his brother died. And she says, look, this is it. I'm selling the farm. Your father can't go on anymore. We need to face reality. Come home for the final harvest. This is your last chance. So, like I say, on the face of it, it's a homecoming story, but not really. This is a book about redemption, identity, masculinity in crisis, our relationship to the land, in the environment, everything. And it's all condensed into this one property in these 3 hectic weeks where they have to bring in a crop and, in a way, settle a lot of debts that are both personal and emotional. So it's quite an intense book from start to finish.
There's so many themes there that we're going to get to, but the first thing I want to ask you is, what are the origins of Locust Summer? So where did it, you know, spark from? How did it evolve to be this beautiful novel?
Well, I was a journalist for a long time and I worked, my first posting was with GWN, Golden West News, in Geraldton. So I was about 21 at the time and I'm a city kid. I've never really been out of the city apart from, I'd done some travel, but, you know, I'd never lived outside. And so I had this quite confronting experience of living in Geraldton and reporting on the Midwest for about a year. And I really got to know the Midwest and Gascoyne regions quite well. And I just fell in love with the landscape and the people and the romance of farming. I mean, that sort of, you know, Banjo Paterson kind of ideal of it. But then when I worked in Kalgoorlie for the ABC, I made good friends with a journalist there who, his family had a property over in New South Wales. And because I'd always been interested in farming, one day he said, look, would you like to come for the harvest? And I said, of course. So I booked 3 weeks off work, flew over to Sydney with him, and then we went out to his place. And I worked just as a general hand on the harvest. You know, by the end, I got to drive the harvester for a couple of runs, which was pretty good. And it was just this transcendent experience. It was something that I think every 24-year-old kind of needs to do. You know, it's not necessarily about being strong, it's about feeling strong, and that I could handle something that was outside this white-collar world that I was inhabiting with journalism. And journalism's all about observing, but here I was doing. And kind of about the same time, my grandfather developed dementia. And as that progressed, that was very, very hard, a lot of the things that I was seeing in there. And these two worlds kind of combined after he died. I was working as a journalist over in London, and I just knew I needed to write something. It had always been there in the back of my mind that journalism was a way of me gathering experiences enough to qualify, I suppose, as a writer. A lot of the writers I really admire have gone a similar path, at least. And I was deliciously bored in a seminar one day, a travel seminar. And I just started writing about a place where meridian lines of sun and soil combined to make the most perfect wheat growing conditions on the planet. And I thought, well, who would be unhappy there? And then from there, everything spun. So some of those original lines that I jotted in that notebook while I was really bored have actually survived into the manuscript. There's only one or two of them, but I'm quite happy that the original seeds are still within the book.
Yeah, that's right. They're like little gold nuggets in there. I wonder if anyone can find them. That's so
good. Challenge you.
So one of the main themes of the novel you talked about, there's lots of things going on, obviously. And so one of the main things is that of belonging. So there's this belonging to the land, there's belonging to the community, this community of Septimus that comes together a lot and then and supports each other there even through the harvest. There's also belonging in your family. So, for example, we've got Rowan's mother. She's lived on this property in Septimus for 30 years, but she says she still doesn't feel like a local. And as you say, Rowan, after the death of his brother, he's exiled himself to the coast. He's away from his family. He's in the city. Were you conscious of those kinds of ideas when writing the novel? As you said, like the idea came from who could ever be unhappy in this perfect wheat-growing place. Was that something that really followed you through writing it?
That's the edge. That's the sharpness. Writing about somebody who was happy there and these things were all happening to them and it was woe is me, you could do that. But for me, that didn't appeal because a lot of ways I've always felt like an outsider. Being a journo makes you an outsider, and that appeals to me. I grew up a red-headed, pale-skinned boy in the northern suburbs with an Italian last name. I didn't quite fit the mould, so I like the notion, at least, of being an outsider. And from a story perspective, I think it's easy, not easier, but it's there's more opportunity for you as a writer if your character is a slight fish out of water. I think one of the greatest examples of that is the Aubrey Maturin series. It's the Master and Commander books where it's all set on a tall ship in the 18th century, but you know, if you don't know the front of the ship from the back, how are you going to navigate the world? But Patrick O'Brien, the writer, created a surgeon who comes aboard the ship, and so through his ignorant eyes, complexity can be explained. But in saying that, Rowan, my protagonist, is of that world. He is, in a way, deeply interested in the mechanics of the harvest. He glories in describing it. It's just he's not of it. He's from it, but not of it. And I liked the interplay of that. I liked that sharp edge of who am I and what am I doing here? I love this, but I don't. You know, he calibrates his whole life to his dislike of a place that he loves. And that's very confusing, but so is life. And I think that's what I was searching for. I was searching for a way to access the complexity of people. We're not simple. I think when you sit down to create a character, you know, you can create as much of a profile of them as you like. You know, this is their favorite food and all that kind of stuff. But if you forget that people are, we're just weird. We don't make sense. And if there's no chaos to the order that you're trying to bring, then I think it just doesn't pop. And earlier versions of Rowan were quite logical and sensible, and it was only when I shook the jar a bit and embraced that like you say, that outsider thing that I think it worked.
Yeah, because he is quite emotional, and it's clear from his childhood he was always wanting to be the reader, whereas the brother who's passed away, he was into everything. You know, he had planned his whole life around eventually taking over the farm, and Rowan was always, that was never in his cards. When you went out and did this harvest as a journalist, as a city boy, how did that inform you kind of building Rowan? How did that work out for you?
Aside from giving me, I suppose, the technical knowledge, because I was pretty aware of that, you know, you're proud to say that a lot of country readers have said, yep, that's how it is, although but a lot of people have said, why didn't they fire up that old harvester from the beginning? They're the most reliable ones. But, you know, like, because story. But the main thing I would say is that doing the harvest gave me an appreciation for, in a way, how dedicated people were. There's a part in the book where some sheep are stuck in a dam. That really happened on that harvest. It's not exactly how it happened, but I tried to dig them out. I really did. I spent about an hour just trying to dig these poor sheep out of a waterhole. And I remember going up to the man who was the shepherd of the property and saying to him, look, these sheep are stuck there. And I thought that he'd be quite dismissive, stupid bloody animals or whatever, you know, because people are, I suppose, hardened to that kind of thing. But he was upset because that was his job, and he had to do that very difficult but ultimately necessary thing of putting them down. So that was his responsibility. So that really clued me into this sort of thing. It's not just about that this is hard work. It's that there is a duty and a responsibility to it. And it's nothing to do with gender or position or anything like that. It's just we're all in this together and we have to do this. And so I was glad I did that harvest because it moved me just beyond the simple mechanics of it. It sort of clued me into maybe the emotional undercurrents of belonging to this. And I think that's where Rowan goes a bit wrong. They're all waiting for him to step up and just do your job, mate. Just take responsibility. But because he views that so much as his identity, that it will destroy his identity, he's resisting that.
Yeah, every time he's kind of on the verge of stepping up, he almost self-sabotages. You know, he does something to kind of prove to himself that, yeah, I'm not meant to be here, Things like that. I was interested when you said about this, the shepherd, and you thought, oh, if I tell him about these sheep, he'll be dismissive, but actually he did really care about them. And that's possibly our listeners who are less city folk than us will be going, well, of course, you know, he cares about them. But I really like in the novel, it's got such this typical Australian qualities in lots of ways. You know, it's wheat farm, it's harvest time, they're going to the pub, you know, there are sheep getting stuck in stuff, they're driving across salt flats. It's very Australian in lots of ways. And yet it's got these real much darker undercurrents, lots of nuance, the characters behaving in ways we don't necessarily expect them to behave, but especially in relation to the land. What do you feel like the novel is saying about the environment and the responsibility that those farming families feel towards the environment?
It's funny, I was just at Bulabadi, the new museum, and they've got a wonderful exhibit about the creation of the wheat belt from space. It's this basically denuded, half sickle shaped run of wheat farms that, you know, goes basically from Kalbarri all the way down to Esperance and, you know, that kind of area. And, you know, there's very, very little remnant vegetation left. And then they've got, in the museum, they had, old footage of people towing these enormous balls behind, you know, metal balls behind tractors and just clearing this. And on the one hand, it's like complete environmental destruction. And it's heartbreaking. And you look at it and go, wow, like, think of all of the vegetation that was lost, all the animals and the salinity that came from that. Yeah, so, yeah, seen from space, it's this incredible bout of environmental destruction. But on the other hand, it's the bedrock of, I suppose, settler economy, of Western Australia's regular economy that, at least in the early days and still continuing, it's many people's identity, it's their where they live, it's part of this world that exists now. And so there's this, I don't know, just this, like I said before, this hinge point there. And that's why the salinity is really important in the book, because the environment's very important to me and I wanted to include that because it's not just giving carte blanche, you know, that this is how it is. It's not, it came at a massive cost. But at the same time, West Australian farmers are country leading in their renewal and management of land. You know, I went over to South Australia and I was shocked. You know, there's no windbreak trees. It's just a huge flensing of dust that comes off the Gulf there. Whereas farmers in WA, from my time as a journo, I watched them planting, you know, remnant vegetation back and pulling the, you know, getting the water table to go down and managing their land and using, you know, consulting Indigenous groups and bringing that knowledge back. And so the book itself, I really wanted to present a realistic version of the country that people would go, that's how it is, that's the truth of it. That it is complex, that it is improving, that there were bad things and that there were good things. I never wanted to stray into any sort of stereotypical territory. That was really challenging to do because it's a rural story, it's a homecoming story. You've got the farm gate, the wild dogs, you've got the mum, you've got the dad, you've got all these things. You can basically make it like on our selection, but know that the duty that you have is to present the truth. And I think maybe that harks back to my origins as a journalist, in that I was always really frustrated that you could never tell the truth in just one story. You always had to build up a number of stories, and then that would present a whole thing. But because of the nature of news, people only have one story at a time, and it's very hard for people to build the entire picture. But with a book, you know, I had, 42 odd chapters to present a mosaic of experiences that I feel reflect the complexity and the of that situation. Because like I say, life's complex and life's weird and multi-layered and nuanced. And if I've captured that in any way, then I'm happy.
Yeah, because this farm has been in the Brockman family for generations. There is this kind of expectation up until the older brother Albert dies that the oldest son will take it on. But this father who is suffering from dementia over the course of the novel, he's kind of obviously in love with his farm, but also he says maybe he shouldn't have been a farmer. And then both he and his wife towards the end, what they want to do is to give the farm back to the environment as much as possible. They want it to be rewilded, that kind of thing. They're very concerned about the traditional owners of the land, in this case the Yamaji people, and what's been done to them over the course of having settlers farming on the land. And all of these aspects of the novel are so timely, but yet it's set in 1986, so it's over 35 years old. What drew you to that time period in particular?
Well, I was born in 82, so I kind of remember this era. To me, that era is very interesting because, well, one of my private obsessions is the America's Cup, which is mentioned in the story, particularly the Frio edition. I remember being on a boat watching some of that. But to me, it's this hinge point in WA's history. It's this hinge point in WA's, at least, modern-day settler history. And that, well, after Gough Whitlam and the dismissal and seven, I don't want to mansplain this too much, but it was the 79, you know, the 100-year anniversary of WA, that everyone had the T-shirts. People were becoming much more aware of history and our place in it and what we wanted our identity to be, at least the collective identity to be. That appealed to me. You know, it was a time of great change. You know, billions of dollars were being spent to gussy Fremantle up for the America's Cup races because all of a sudden the eye of the world was going to be on us. Things were changing. We were ripping down heritage buildings. We were building skyscrapers. You know, that's when the rendezvous went on to Scarborough Beach. I've heard it pronounced Rendus Vass, which is always great.
Very Australian.
Very Australian. But so that appealed to me as a period of where I could present change, because Rowan is having to grow up, and you want the time period to evoke that. So to me, the way I structured the book in the charting Rowan's journey, like mathematically, I know Graham Greene did this with a lot of his characters, that Rowan goes from, I would say, minus 10 at the start to zero at the end. So it's a homecoming story, but it's not it's a redemption story, but it doesn't show you that redemption. It shows you the possibility of that redemption and the journey that it takes to get to zero and to begin with a blank slate, at least partly a blank slate. There's an opportunity in the air. So with all that change in the air in that period, that really appealed. I think that just gave a good atmosphere to that.
And so is there anything else about the novel? You've been doing lots of interviews. I know you've been at writers' festivals. Is there anything that no one's asked you about yet that you just really want to take the chance to say?
Oh, yes, it's been exhausting and the phones never stop ringing. No, one thing that I was actually quite, that was very challenging to write in the story was men at work. And it's a bit of a fraught topic these days, I suppose, but I didn't want to just have the work crew just be a bunch of, you know, bloody this and bloody that Aussie guys swearing blue murder and cussing each other out and doing the work. I think that was the easy way. It's that I had to strip away, okay, well, how do men interact with each other when it's positive? How do men interact with each other when it's negative? How do you earn respect? How do you gain respect? How do you show disrespect within this circle? And it all comes down to work. And work is such a, in a stereotypical way, a bedrock of identity. So that was very interesting territory to try to work in. So I'll let people be the judge of how that went.
Well, if I can be the judge, there's a character in the book called Sterler who's been working on the farm for 20 years. Yep. And I really like going back to the aspect of belonging again, that he doesn't want to own the land, he just wants to belong to the land, he says. And his feelings about the land and the work and respect for each other and how you behave on the harvest is really complex, and he's a really interesting guy who clearly has very deep feelings about the land and about what should be done. And yeah, so just in terms of him, I think you've really captured it. So as you know, I was really fortunate to win the Fogarty Literary Award for 18 to 35 year old West Australian writers.
And I know, so, yeah. I was there. I'm still stoked.
Still stoked too. And yeah, not everyone gets that chance. Like it's an amazing chance. You've had quite a similar experience. So Locust Summer was shortlisted for the Vogel, that's another really prestigious award for unpublished manuscripts for young writers. But we both remember those anxious times where we were wondering, are we ever going to get a novel published? And so for writers who are just at the beginning of their careers who are listening to this, what's one thing that you really wish you had known when you were starting out?
Not to fixate so much on publication. Because I really did. And the Vogel had a lot to do with that, in the sense that I was shortlisted. That came completely out of the blue. I was 35. It's an under 35 award. And there were five of us picked, and we were all 35. So we called ourselves the last chances.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience. I got my photo taken. I had in the paper the worst photo. Google it. It's the worst photo of me ever taken. It's incredible. And then Extract of Locust Summer was published in The Australian. I flew over to Sydney for the gala award ceremony, but I didn't win, and everybody else got picked up by a publisher but me, and I walked away with three books and five boxes of cereal, because the Vogels is they're a cereal company. But this is the thing, this sounds very entitled, doesn't it? I should have got this and I should have got that. And then it sort of spun me into a very odd place where I was like, well, what's wrong with this book? Why isn't it good enough? And then it hit me like a bullet that it wasn't good enough, that I needed to do more work. And from a period of fixating so much on, woe is me and why wasn't this book getting picked up, I just remembered I had to do the work. And then I got a phone call saying, you've been selected for a fellowship at Varuna, the National Writers' House. And I was like, right. So I went there for 2 weeks and I worked with Tony Jordan, Gabriel Carey and Judith Russell, who were just heavy hitters who schooled me. And I had 2 weeks of walking around the Blue Mountains and retooling this work, and then went off on the caravan trip for 2 years writing Locust Summer whenever I could, and just doing the work, forgetting about being published. And that is really hard to do, I think, when you've been so close with the Vogel. I sort of thought, is this just all for nothing? Should I just stop and write something else? Or do I believe in the story enough to keep going? And Laurie Steed, my writing mentor and someone who I worked with in the editorial process very deeply in the manuscript stage, just said to me, look, you just got to go a bit crazy, man. You just got to embrace it. You just got to go all the way out and not worry about the result in the sense that it gets published. Just do the work and make it the best that you can, because looking back, if I'd won, I think it would have been a really bad book. Mm. I hadn't been on the journey. I hadn't done that. So if there's anything I could say, it sounds easy from someone who's been published, oh, don't worry about being published, but it's free yourself from that worry. Free yourself from that pressure. I mean, I'm going through it now with book two. I'm just sort of like, it is what it is. Let it be what it is. And don't worry too much about the ultimate thing, because being published is a very separate thing to the creative process. I think you're probably finding that it's an entirely different world. And enjoy the creative bit for as much as you can, and keep it separate from the other part.
Mm. And I like that, it wasn't good enough, and that you kept working on it, and now you've got this book that you're so proud of, and in the alternate reality where you won, maybe you wouldn't. So
maybe, I would have had 3 months to turn that manuscript into something that would have been published, and I just don't think it would have stacked up. And I thank my lucky stars that I didn't.
I got the
2 years. Yeah. It all makes sense when you look back, and when you've forgotten the pain of it.
And so do you think that your career, as you've said, you've been a journalist, you've been a freelance writer, how has that contributed to being a novelist?
It's a good question. I don't think it made me a creative writer.
Mm-hmm.
Journalism is very much about the gathering and dissemination of facts in an orderly way. That's one of the main themes of Locust Summer. How can Rowan, the journalist, open himself up to life, the artistry of life? And that's maybe a little bit of my story, because I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I joined the army for writers, basically. You know, where they teach you to kill with the ABC. So it teaches you to write to a deadline. It teaches you to be very organised in your habits. But at the same time as well, I think it's more, it's about experiences. It's about opening yourself up to experiences. I was basically paid by the ABC for 5 years to have adventures. Mm. And I did all kinds of stuff. Same with the BBC, same with Al Jazeera. I just did wonderful things and met so many people and filled notebooks with sketches of people and ticket stubs. And, you know, I'm like a bowerbird. I collect all kinds of stuff. But I have some quotes to read, which I think support this.
Fantastic.
So I'm reading Leaping into Waterfalls, The Enigmatic Gillian Mears by Bernadette Brennan. And it's fabulous. It's all about Gillian Mears and her artistic life. Mm-hmm. And there's two quotes. This is very good. So she's transcribed this from May Sarton's Journal of a Solitude. My own belief is that one regards oneself, if one is a serious writer, as an instrument for experiencing life. All of it flows through this instrument and is distilled through it into works of art. I love that, because it makes me think, well, I always had it in the back of my head, you know, I'm just collecting stuff. I mean, the early literary heroes, Graham Greene and Ernest Hemingway and Ford Madox Ford, guys like that, turn of the century sort of writers, they viewed it like that. And we're all products of our experience and our imagination, and it's how brave are you in digging into that. And so, you know, they say, write what you know. Well, I'm not a country boy, but I know enough in order to do that. And so when I finally had the courage to listen to the voice inside my head, I knew I had the skill set from journalism to at least do the basics, but the rest, breaking out of that journo shell to actually be artistic, that was hard. Mm. Still hard. It's hard to call myself a writer, but I'm embracing that more and more.
Yeah, and I think people would say, as someone with a novel, they would say, you're a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's only after three, you know, it's like being an ace, you know, you've got to have like five novels and you can say you're a writer.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. It's been
absolutely amazing to talk to you and learn a little bit more about how this wonderful book came to be. You've really had some glowing, well-earned reviews. So Tony Jordan said that few novels have such quiet authority and insight, and Westerly called it rich, complex, heart-wrenching novel, and the Australian Women's Weekly has said that it was powerfully poignant and beautifully crafted. And I think all of those comments encapsulate as best as possible just how wonderful this book is. You've really done a beautiful job. I really love the book. I'm not just saying that. I really, really do.
I'm looking forward to yours.
Oh, me too. But so where can people buy Locust Summer?
Where all good books are sold. You can order it directly from Fremantle Press as well through the website, but also support your local bookstore.
Yeah, definitely. That was David Alan Patali talking to us about his novel Locust Summer. So if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on your favourite app. I'm Brooke Tennell, Fogarty Award winner and the author of The Glasshouse, and I look forward to joining you next time as we talk to yet another fantastic storyteller from the West.